Welcome to our July Planet Possible mini pod. I'm Nikki Roach, and this is a monthly update where we react to current events in water, nature, and climate. And it's a mini pod because it'll only take about 15 minutes of your time, and it means you get a Planet Possible episode every 2 weeks. We're grateful to our sponsors, BMA, Mackley, and MWH Treatment for helping us bring this mini pod to you. And as usual, I'm joined by an environmental expert, and we'll explore three issues that are making the headlines, keeping you right up to date with what's happening around the world and where my guests see some exciting possibilities. So this mini-pod, my guest is Adam Bedford, the Collaborative Projects Director at Ferroscience, and we'll be talking about the news that more than 80% of farmers are worried about the climate crisis harming their livelihood. A group of British, Ukrainian and Dutch engineers trying to rebuild Ukraine as efficiently and sustainably as possible by recycling the rubble from bombed buildings to make new concrete. And we consider the impact of the recent final report from the Independent Water Commission on our farming communities and agriculture. So welcome to the mini-pod, Adam. Great to have you with us.
I'm pleased to be here. Nice to see you.
So for listeners that might not have heard of Ferro, give us a 30-second explainer on who they are and what they do.
Ferroscience has been around for a long time in different guises. It used to be the Central Science Laboratories for Government, so the sponsoring department was DEFRA, and then it was privatised, so it's a joint venture between the private sector and government. And we work across the public and private sectors, across the agri-food chain. We're a science services organisation, so we've got about 400 or so scientists working across a range of agri-food topics to essentially reduce the environmental cost of food production. How do we have sustainable agriculture and a thriving natural environment? And we're doing that from a science park in York.
Let's start with a recent piece of research that suggests that more than 80% of farmers are worried about the climate crisis harming their livelihood.
Yeah, this was an article that really jumped out to me. It was in The Guardian. A piece of research carried out at the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. The study found 87% of farmers have experienced reduced productivity in the face of extreme weather, 84% had suffered a fall in crop yields, and more than three quarters had taken a hit to their income. It really resonated with me because it feels like farmers are really at the front end of climate change. I'm not sure this is a political podcast, but I'll make a political point. It feels like net zero has kind of been politicised in some ways, which is clouding the issues as to what we do about this. Whereas you've got farmers on the ground who are trying to grow crops or look after livestock and, you know, look after the land, who are facing into the very real issues of climate change now. For a study to actually ask them, what is it like to be a farmer, I found really refreshing because we've then got to do something about that. If farmers are either worried about the future or are facing climate impacts now, when we know what the long-term projections would be if we don't learn how to mitigate this and do something about it, that's not just going to affect farmers in the future, it's going to affect all of us as we come out of our, you know, third heat wave and then what you would describe as probably a significant rain event recently as well. I see sort of combines rolling at harvest time, as harvest has been early, probably for some people a month earlier than normal, which is a climate impact, how dry it's been. But then just as they get into the bulk of the UK crop of wheat, the heavens opened. I can see it around where I live. I just think it's important to give that voice to farmers because it's so important to the wider things that we all work on and the wider things that you discuss in your podcast.
Are you finding farmers already starting to adapt and think about what they might need to do differently given the unpredictability of the weather and the seasons that we're starting to see?
Very much so, and it can come from different perspectives as well, because, you know, one might be, where is the climate change impact in agriculture? A bulk of it is tied up in inputs, isn't it? You know, the fertiliser and other products that we put in, that's a climate change impact. So you've got a lot of farmers increasingly, from both an environmental and an economic perspective, focused on that. You know, what different inputs can we use? How can we take account of using natural fertilisers, manures and other things, and do that in a way? Obviously, there's impacts there into other stories that we might want to talk about as well, which needs to be managed. But I think farmers are really looking at new ways to do things, facing into some of the challenges that come from, you know, some of the work that we do at Ferro around pests and diseases, viruses and things like that, which can also be weather related as well. You know, are we facing challenges that either we haven't seen for a while, new pests and diseases that are coming along as a result of a changing climate? Yes, we are. Some of the things that we're working with farmers on is around how do you model that over time? Because if we know where we're at now, what does that look like in the future with the climate data that we've got? So in many ways, when I'm talking to farmers, I sort of think this is a really, really difficult time in many ways. But it's also a really exciting time because from times like this comes innovation. Sort of glass half full type of person. I think it's quite exciting, actually, because there's no choice but to deal with this. We've got to face into this. And the answers are there, but we've got to work together.
And Adam, from your perspective, do you think that the future of farming in the UK is going to change slowly over time, or can you see something that's much more radical that's needed to be able to adapt to the climate and nature challenges that we've got?
I think it will depend on the type of farm that you're on, definitely. But I think what we're already seeing is, when you've got the rise of new natural capital markets, there's a huge amount of confusion around that, but I think there's a lot of opportunity. But what does that actually mean for an individual farmer or an estate? It can be quite difficult for them to work out. But it will be that over time, as that market develops, farmers and landowners will be able to make decisions as to, you know, does this area of land, is this the best place for food production? Is this the best place for a BNG type of approach?
Biodiversity net gain.
Or, you know, some of the natural capital markets. There's real economic opportunities there, which are obviously addressing environmental issues, or even areas for tree planting as well. It makes sense to do that. But just as an example, I was with a group of farmers probably about a month ago now, where I chaired a panel of farmers, and it was about climate adaptation and what were they doing on their farms. Honestly, it was the most positive and uplifting discussion, because they were talking about their experience that they'd had, and it was a range of different types of farmers, some mixed farmers with livestock on arable, some straight arable farmers, and some upland farmers. And there were four of them on the panel all talking about, well, we started to do this because it was drier, or we started to do this because that part of land got particularly wet and we couldn't farm it in the way that we did. The point I would leave you with, they went up and down the panel, the sort of message that came out at the end was always, so we started doing that and it really started to work, so we did a little bit more. I left there thinking, yeah, all of the ideas for how we do this and to adapt are there in the farming industry. It's just about piecing everybody together and everybody learning from each other and everybody having the understanding that probably nobody's got it fully worked out. I just thought it was really positive, you know, aside from a headline here on this story, which is 80% of people are worried about climate change. You know, yes, they are, but they're doing things.
Exactly that. You can be worried and that can drive you towards action. And it sounds like actually just connecting some of the dots there and sharing some of that best practice, because every piece of land is relatively unique, isn't it? So what works for one won't necessarily work for another. Brilliant. Right, let's move on from climate and farming in the UK to something a bit more international. So what's caught your eye with this story in Ukraine?
A piece in the Times. So the headline is, a smart way to rebuild Ukraine, recycle the rubble. Just some numbers from the article before I tell you what I think about it. So the toll of destruction in Ukraine at present, 209,000 houses, 27,000 apartment buildings, just shy of 300 schools, 1,500 medical facilities, and just under 400 religious buildings destroyed. This will cost to rebuild $524 billion over 10 years. So eye-watering sums of money. But the article is essentially saying you've got 10% of CO2 emissions come from the production of concrete in the world. And essentially, we've got to rebuild a very significant country. So there's a group of engineers and scientists who, in part, I think, are funded by the British government, British, Ukrainian, Dutch engineers. They're essentially taking the rubble back to its constituent parts in order to make new products to rebuild. If you were to use, you know, brand new materials to rebuild, then that's just going to be a disaster for the country and for the environment. And we don't need to do that. So the story goes into talking about, you know, when they get this right, there will be a series of small plants, factories, whatever the description would be, around Ukraine, where the rubble is able to be then separated into its constituent parts. It blew my mind. I found it fascinating. I thought, what does that mean for the future? What else is there? And, you know, a previous story was about farming, but I'm also thinking about Ukraine, which is the breadbasket, really. If you can do that, what else will you need to do from a farming perspective? How will we remediate land? And I suppose I chose it because it's such a disastrous situation in Ukraine and horrific. But actually, we do have to think about the environmental impacts of this, because we will need to rebuild the country and we've got to think about how we do that. So in many ways, the story gave me hope, because just like climate change discussions, sometimes out of bad situations can come unbelievable innovations, because it has to be done. And this feels to me like an example of something that just has to be done, and I found it inspiring.
Well, when you shared it with me, I thought similarly, really interesting. Few things that jumped out to me. We had an episode earlier on this year with Sue Jefferson from Circular Malton and Norton, talking about circular economy principles, which is exactly what this is, isn't it? This is the most extreme, I think, example of circular economy in action I think I've ever heard of. And the other thing, unbeknownst to you, we're doing an episode a little bit later on this year where we talk about conflict and sustainability. Even thinking about the challenges of maintaining, you know, water and wastewater and basic services, exactly as you said, what's applicable in a conflict zone? But then actually, How do you then use those kind of approaches for non-conflict situations, for buildings that have just reached their end of life? What could we do if we're building on brownfield sites to get the most out of what we are taking down rather than needing to extract new materials?
If you think about things that have happened in previous wars as well, technologies that were developed often for, well, warmongering purposes actually ended up having real world applications, didn't they? Because people brought the clarity of mind to an issue, and it was done quickly, and the money and investment was there to do it, and the people were there, and there was a real focus. And it feels like this story in many ways is that, you know, we have to prepare for this and we have to do this. We can't say we're working on this, we'll be able to do this in 10 years time. We've got to rebuild a country.
Right, big one. Interesting. Let's move on to our third and final topic. And for listeners that might have listened to our special episode that's gone out, we've talked about the Independent Water Commission's final report that's just come out. So if you want the detail on that, go back and have a listen to that. But I was interested, Adam, to focus in particular on that report and the links to, back to agriculture with you. So the Commission, amongst its 88 recommendations, made a really strong link back to the importance of catchments and river basins and how everything is connected together. So it talked about creating 9 new bodies, 8 in England and 1 in Wales, regional water bodies that brought together players that you would expect, like the water companies, but also how do you bring in other stakeholders? So environmental campaigners, how do you bring in citizen science? How do you bring in agriculture? How do you bring in transport? How do you bring together planning? And how do you think about all of those in a kind of regional and place-based way so that you can implement long-term national water strategy? And I was then reflecting, you know, you've got farmers sitting throughout that. So from a water resources perspective, key for food security, have we got sufficient water? Farmers are the custodians, really, of water in the landscape, aren't they, for much of the time? And then what they then add to the land, 30% of the contributions to rivers not achieving the right quality standards come from agriculture, something we don't talk about all that often, but it's part of that wider debate around the quality of the water we want. I would love to hear your reflections as somebody who's really connected into that farming community on the report, really.
Yeah, I mean, think about water, either water quality issues or water quantity issues. Agriculture's front and centre of that. And, you know, you've got farmers and landowners having the ability to hold water, depending what the system is in place. You've got, particularly in the sort of times we're living in, you know, many parts of the country under significant water stress and, you know, a real need for access to water for abstraction. And then the other point of it, which I often do talk to farmers about, it's quite difficult, but to say, you know, there is an environmental impact from agriculture and we should talk about that. I think it's really welcome, and I say, to really bring a focus onto specific areas or catchments to bring all parties together, because I don't think in agriculture, I don't think a farmer wakes up in the morning and thinks, I'm going to go and damage that waterway. That's not how it works. But there's a lot of pressure on agriculture. If these new catchment organisations, whatever we'll end up calling them, don't become a talking shop, but do give a voice to everybody who's got an impact. And I think there's a clear difference there, because there's always a risk, isn't there, you know, with anything that comes from government, that you start to set up new structures which take time to bed in, yet the issue that you're trying to address is, you know, keeps rumbling on. So I think that will be something that the government will have to really be careful of, because there's been a lot of people, whether that's those in agriculture, the environment movement, regulators or elsewhere, have been waiting for this report. The case is that we're going to have to adapt and do different things in the future. And therefore, and water is fundamental to that. And that will mean some difficult conversations. It may be some difficult conversations with the agricultural community around some production methods which may be having a detrimental impact on water quality. It may be a difficult conversation with local communities because a new reservoir needs to be built. It may be a difficult conversation about public funding which may have gone to one area that needs to go to some infrastructure instead. So clearly, there's going to be a series of trade-offs, but the clarity that's come from having an independent report, which has been a long time in the making, on a hot political topic, whatever your political perspective, and then to come forward with a series of recommendations and this is how you do it, I think is really welcome. The key is that everybody will have to work together, because everybody wants to make sure that we've got good access to water and whatever it is that you're doing, but we also want to have good water quality. All of us do. So why would we not work together? And the final thing I'd say as well, which gives me real heart, an example of a project that I'm working on at Ferry with a group of farmers who wanted to improve the water quality on a beck that runs through the village that they live in and the farms that they're working on. And the conversation actually started with them around what did it used to be like on the Beck? We don't see as many kingfishers as we used to do, for example. Now, how do we get them back? So then starting that discussion around, well, actually, maybe we need some nature-based solutions in this area of the Beck. You could farm a little bit differently there. So it's an example of a project, if you like, which is not, and I hope that these groups that come together, whatever the different perspectives are, it's about everybody working together to not say, you water company are doing this, you farmers are doing this, you know, you highways are doing this. Like, look, everybody recognises there's a problem here and we all want the same outcomes. Let's work together. And on that basis, I think it's positive.
And actually, so many of the solutions have to be joined up anyway, because no one sector can deliver them by themselves. Oh, Adam, that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for joining us. You can subscribe to Planet Possible on your usual podcast player to never miss an episode. That's it, everyone. Stay curious, stay connected, and we'll see you next time.